Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few women, few people for that matter, I know who bring more intelligence to bear on the war for the free world and have done so for longer than our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Vice President for Research and Analysis, Claire Lopez. Claire brings with her to this important position a wealth of experience, much of it inside the intelligence community, as a matter of fact. She served for some 20 years as a clandestine officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. She's been very actively contributing to the public policy debate, notably, but not exclusively, through her writings through the center, a couple of monographs to her credit. She edited the terrific book, Sharia, the Threat to America, and you can find her in many of the videos that we've produced at the center's securefreedom.org website. Claire Lopez, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you with us, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. There's so much to talk about. I'm very keen to do so with you.
Oh, isn't there? Thank you, Frank. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, unfortunately, not much of it is good, but we'll work our way through it and benefit from your counsel as to what should be done about it. Let's start, Claire, with the latest acts of violence against police officers in Baton Rouge. Give us a flavor of what seems to be going on, both in that immediate instance, but more broadly at the moment.
Well, the shooter in Baton Rouge, and this would have been yesterday on Sunday, the 17th of July, was Gavin Eugene Long. He formerly was a member of the Nation of Islam, although it's not clear that he still was as of the time of the shooting. And obviously, he had planned out his attack against Baton Rouge police officers, killing three, injuring three more, one of whom we understand is still fighting for his life in the hospital. He's not the only one. He is just the latest. As we recall, unfortunately, just a short few days ago was the massacre of police officers in Dallas, Texas. And when you look at the social media pages, for instance, of these individuals, Micah Xavier Johnson was the shooter there in Dallas, killing five police officers. And you look at his feed online, it is just hate-filled screed against police officers. Certainly, it's terribly racist stuff, very violent stuff. And this is apparently coming to a head this hot summer of 2016.
Claire, speaking of the hot summer, things that seem to be contributing to how hot it will be is the convergence, it would appear, of several different, well, forces, shall we say. I'm not sure whether they're exactly organized groups or factions even, but forces in our polity. You've mentioned one that this chap in Baton Rouge was previously associated with, namely an Islamist group known as the Nation of Islam. There are, of course, the Occupy folks of sort of Alinskyite fame and agendas. And then, of course, there are the black grievance mongers, the Black Lives Matter, perhaps the new Black Panther Party. Is there evidence that you're familiar with that these folks are actually converging, joining forces to afflict our society and not just our police officers?
Yes, unfortunately there is. You're exactly right, Frank. Well, what we're seeing is what I've been calling an unholy alliance among, just as you say, three, you might think disparate, but now linked sets of groups, maybe the way to put it. The first I would name is the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood and all of its affiliates and its umbrella organization, the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. Prominent in this grouping is CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations and its executive director, Nihad Awad. The second grouping, led by the Black Lives Matter movement, racist, violent, anti-American street thug type of organizations, and a lot of their associated black nationalist, black separatist groups that literally some of them call for carving out a separate nation within a nation for blacks within America. The third grouping, I call them the Alinskyite anarchists, and these are truly those who follow the rules for radicals' ideology of Saul Alinsky, and include groups like MoveOn.org, Occupy Wall Street, F the Police, Communist Party USA, and others affiliated with them. And then what I guess I should add to that list of three are the funders whose money keeps them all going. And prominent among these funders is one George Soros, but there are others.
Claire, this sort of red-green axis, now perhaps red-green-black axis, has been, of course, documented, among other things, by a terrific book by our colleague Jim Simpson of that name, The Red-Green Axis. You've also been covering this. We have some videotape of a woman who has invoked this idea of revolution from the stage of the Muslim American Society, another of these Muslim Brotherhood fronts in the United States. Give us a flavor of the particular role being played by this group that I suspect most of us have never heard of, the U.S. Council on Muslim Organizations.
Sure. Well, the woman you are referring to is one Khalila Sabra, African-American convert to Islam, who appeared some months ago at a conference, and she is an employee of a Muslim Brotherhood front group, Muslim American Society, but also works as a consultant or a contractor for Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice, where she provides advice on immigration matters. And what she said in her video sums up what we're talking about here, I think. And this video posted to the Center for Security Policy website and also available on YouTube at this point. And she said, "We are the community that staged a revolution across the world. If we could do that, why can't we have that revolution in America?" Now, when she said "we," I suspect she was referring to the Muslim Brotherhood, of which she's a part. But she's touching on this red-green axis precisely that Jim Simpson did such a good job of describing in his book, the monograph for the center of that name, Red-Green Axis, which is the alliance among the Muslim Brotherhood groups. And in the United States, yes, plus Black Lives Matter. The umbrella group that we're talking about here is called the USCMO, U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. By the way, there are councils of Muslim organizations just like this, umbrella groups of Muslim Brotherhood member groups all across the world, in particular the Western world, meaning Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and other places.
And but is for there here, in the United evidence? States, yeah, is there evidence of their collaboration globally? And to what end, Claire Lopez?
Well, the evidence of the global network was on full view at a February 2016 conference. The first international conference of Muslim councils in the West took place in Crystal City, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., where these representatives from all over the world had gathered. And there we saw not just the representatives of Muslim Brotherhood groups all over the country and the world, the Western world in particular, but envoys from the U.S. government. For instance, the U.S. envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Arsalan Suleiman, was there. We had Representative Keith Ellison, a Democratic representative from Minnesota, as a keynote speaker.
The first Muslim in the United States Congress. Yeah. Hey, Claire, we've got to pause for just a moment. Eyes. When we come back, I want to ask a little bit more about this agenda of the U.S. CMO, the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, and its political agenda. And we'll use that as the springboard to move into some other areas as well with Claire Lopez of the Center for Security Policy right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a special hour-long conversation with the Vice President for Research and Analysis of the Center for Security Policy, a former career clandestine intelligence officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, the formidable Claire Lopez. And Claire, you were talking about this group, the U.S. CMO, and we've written a book on the subject. You've been the driving force behind that, the Star-Spangled Sharia, it's called. Describe, if you would, the overarching political agenda of this U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations.
Well, this U.S. CMO is an umbrella organization comprising dozens now of Muslim Brotherhood organizations in America. As we said a bit ago, prominent leadership in that group include CARE, also MPAC, Muslim Political Affairs Council, and other Muslim Brotherhood front groups in the United States. It was formed in 2014. We document this in that book published for the Center, Star-Spangled Sharia, last year, 2015. Formed in 2014 with an agenda to galvanize the Muslim population in America to be more active in the political arena. I guess maybe that's the best way to put it. They've laid out their leadership, Secretary General Osama Jamal and others, have laid out an agenda for insinuating Muslim Brotherhood objectives into the U.S. political system. Now, ordinarily, we would say any participation and increase in participation by American citizens in the electoral political process would be a good thing. And ordinarily it would be, except when the agenda is driven by the very jihadist Muslim Brotherhood, whose objectives we know, jihad in the way of Allah and dying in jihad, the highest aspiration. So they've laid out this agenda for this election year in particular, 2016 here, to begin fielding candidates at the very lowest levels of the different races, city council, library board, school board, that sort of thing, with the idea that these Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated candidates would some of them be elected and rise up through the political system to eventually, they're playing a long game here.
They are playing a long game. This is very much central to the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood. Of course, its efforts to destroy us from within by our own hands, as they put it. Our guest is Claire Lopez. And Claire, you were talking about this U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations and some of its prominent member groups, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, the Council of Muslim American, Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, and so on. What joins these groups, and for that matter, a whole host of others that we are very concerned about at the moment, notably the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Boko Haram, and so on, is something called Sharia. Would you talk a little bit about that and how these various groups manifested?
Of course, is Islamic law. It is what defines Islamic law. It is a codification of law that was finalized, set in stone. It's immutable. It can't be touched, can't be changed since the 10th century. That is the beginning of the 900s by the scholars of Islam at that time. It bounds the lives of all Muslims everywhere in obedience to Islam. Now, of course, there are lots of Muslims, just like any other faith, who are rather lackadaisical about the practice of their faith and pay more attention to other things like families and jobs. And in this case, it's a good thing, because Sharia is antithetical to the U.S. Constitution and really Western liberal thought overall. It demands inequality between Muslims and non-Muslims, between men and women. It mandates certain horrific, what they call hudud, punishments based on the Quran itself for crimes, in quotes, as they say, for adultery, apostasy, homosexuality, sometimes for slander. So these are things that set Sharia completely at odds with the U.S. Constitution and our laws derived from it. Unfortunately, Muslim Brotherhood, being a jihadist organization and all of its groups and front groups as well, whether they're violent jihadis throwing bombs and shooting guns or the jihadis in suits that we see more often up on Capitol Hill from CARE or ISNA or MPAC and other groups, are all dedicated to the same thing, and that is the global enforcement of Sharia, of Islamic law.
And the creation of some kind of caliphate, I guess, to rule according to it worldwide as
and
well.
And a caliphate, which would be an Islamic state like we see in the Middle East right now, which would be the enforcing mechanism, the enforcing arm, organization of the Islamic state to enforce Sharia in society, which is why the Islamic State over there now that has formed a caliphate for the first time in 100 years is so popular. It is true, pure Islam, and that is also why we're never going to see the Sunni or surrounding Islamic countries of the Middle East region really take them on, because theologically they can't. They haven't a theological Islamic leg to stand on, and they know it.
Hey, Claire, this has of course been a proposition that has been getting a lot more attention of late, thanks in part to the controversy surrounding the man who is at the center of attention at the moment in Cleveland, the Republican nominee in waiting for president, Donald Trump, and his declaration a few months back that we should stop, well, my words, not his, importing more jihadists. And also some rumination on this proposition and more broadly the challenge that we're facing from these Sharia adherent Muslims, again, not all Muslims, but the ones that that are, you know, devoted to this authoritative version of Islam, by Newt Gingrich. Talk, if you would, a little bit about those two aspects of how Americans are beginning to come to grips with the reality of the Sharia business and what you think the way ahead is.
Right. Well, because Sharia is the defining governing structure of Islam itself, and all Muslims everywhere for all time are obligated to obey it, whether they do or not, the problem with bringing in refugees or other kinds of immigrants, asylees, etc., becomes problematic when they are obviously or declared of the Muslim faith. How do you separate out Muslims who perhaps would not care to follow Sharia, who would, in other words, be unfaithful Muslims, from those who indeed are faithful to their own creed? And so when presidential candidate, a presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump, also former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and also I would add Representative Brian Babin of Texas, have all proposed kind of hitting the pause button on refugee and immigration from places or populations where we cannot be sure of the ideological allegiance of those we're proposing to bring to the country.
Yeah, it seems like an eminently sensible approach, and the fact that it's going to doubtless be a subject of some controversy for some time to come, I hope will actually be beneficial in the sense that it will cause more people to reflect on the central nature of this Sharia threat. Claire, let's pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk about this caliphate idea and the role that the president of Turkey seems to be playing in bringing one about as well. That and more with Claire Lopez of the Center for Security Policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, never have so many been so confused for so long about two little words, Allahu Akbar. That would, of course, be the Muslim invocation of divine blessing. Typically, it is uttered by jihadists in the midst of their murderous and often suicidal rampages. We are usually told it translates as, God is great. In fact, it is a supremacist battle cry. God is greater. Even more astonishing than systematic government and media failure to correctly convey the meaning of this phrase is the insistence that its recitation in the act of executing or maiming others is not instructive. This isn't hard. When killers using guns, trucks, suicide bombs, or axes shout Allahu Akbar, they mean for us to die or submit. We better get this right and fight back effectively if we don't like those choices. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Vice President for Research and Analysis, an extraordinary woman and great national security practitioner, Claire Lopez. And Claire, we've been talking about various aspects of this challenge of our time, notably here in America and elsewhere, brought to us by those who believe that it is God's will, Allah's will specifically, to impose this program of Sharia over not just their countries, wherever they may be, but here as well. One of those who is very deeply committed to this, as you know, is the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Over the weekend, there was something that went on. It's been described as a coup. It proved to be half-bliss and short-lived. But give us a little bit of background on Erdogan and his agenda and what it might mean that he has survived this uprising of whatever kind.
Yes, ominous developments. We need to step back really briefly to the 20th century when, after the First World War, what was left of the Ottoman Empire became the modern state of Turkey, led by Mustafa Kemal, came to be known as Ataturk, father of Turks, nickname. And he set Turkey on a modernization, secularized pathway that he intended to bring Turkey into the 20th century at that time. Four times subsequently during the 20th century, the Turkish army, the guardians of the Kemalist agenda, had to step in with either coup d'etats or interventions to set Turkey back on its Kemalist pathway. Well, here we are now in the 20th century, and this past weekend, the remnants of whatever was left of Kemalist adherents inside the military, and obviously they were not very many. They did not have the support of the entire military, and obviously also did not have the support of the majority of Turkish people in the major cities anyway, Istanbul and Ankara, they rose up. They attempted a coup d'etat while Erdogan was out of the capital, away from Ankara, and their intent was to turn Turkey away from its pathway towards a neo-Ottoman jihadist state, which Erdogan and his party, the AKP, have set it on. But as I said, they did not have enough support left among the military, which has been devastated, eviscerated by Erdogan over his tenure, first as prime minister, now as president. And this probably sounds the death knell for the Kemalist agenda, the modernization and secularization of Turkey, which will now be flung back centuries to a jihadist pathway, a jihadist program, which has got all kinds of implications for the United States and for NATO, of which Turkey is a member.
I want to explore those in a moment, but let's just allow me to play the devil's advocate here, because I think this is one thesis as to what happened. I must say, I find rather more persuasive the proposition that this was kind of like the Reichstag fire, which Adolf Hitler engineered in 1933 to intensify his quest and claim to power by having communists, I guess, set fire to the parliament in Berlin. And Claire, it just seems to me, and I don't disagree that the Turkish military has been ravaged by the purges and the prosecutions and the other efforts of Erdogan and his Islamists of the AKP party to bring them to heel, eliminate them essentially as the secular protectors of the Ataturk Republic. But it strikes me as unlikely in the extreme that were the military actually to try to take something like this on, that it would have been executed in such a completely hapless and ineffective way. Tease that out, if you would, please.
Well, what I would say is that I think the failure of the coup attempt and its short-lived nature are testament to exactly what you just said, which is how Erdogan and the AKP have ravaged the military. And again, through repeated purges, arrests, decommissionings, I guess you'd say.
But and insinuating their own people into the ranks, of course, that too.
And making sure that those who are promoted to the top ranks are those, allied with the AKP and with Erdogan. As a matter of fact, as we know in this particular instance, this coup attempt, the coup leaders, who included a few top-level generals and some colonels, as well as many other rank and file, actually had to detain a number of the top Turkish military in order to stage the coup, because those other top military generals would not join them.
Yeah.
So they had to detain them in order to do what they did.
Hey, Claire, there's so much more to talk about here, but let's move along, because I do want to get to this question of whether the Gulenists are also implicated in this, as Erdogan has suggested. You've written, of course, an important book with our colleague Chris Holton at the Center, a monograph on the Gulen movement, and specifically its sort of academic empire in our own country. Tell us who these Gulenists are and whether you think it likely that, in fact, they had a hand in this operation, or whether they're simply going to be one of the victims of the purges that follow from it.
Well, Fethullah Gulen is a Sunni Islamic scholar who began his Islamic clerical career professionally as a teacher, who brought around him, gathered around him circles of students to oppose, at this time, back in the 20th century, the Kemalist agenda that Turkey was steadfastly still adhering to, the secularized form of government there at that time, and drew to him many, many followers and supporters, eventually established a network of schools in Turkey, established a formidable network of business interests there and eventually around the world, was exiled to the United States in 1999, where he's lived in the Poconos in Pennsylvania ever since, and now has established here in the United States a network of schools, charter schools, as well as many cultural centers, and some of his business interests are present here too. There's been a lot of concern, as Chris Holton, our colleague at the center, and I wrote in the book, Gulen and the Gulenist Movement, a concern about those schools, about some of the all-expense-paid trips that was offered, that have been offered to teachers, school administrators, students, legislators, journalists, and others, to promote the Gulenist ideology and agenda. By the way, reading from his own website, which is full of his writings online, it's very easy to see that he is very much in line with the Muslim Brotherhood. He is a jihadist to the core. And in this, he shares ideology with President Erdogan in Turkey. And for a long time, indeed, they were allies in Turkey.
Very close allies for the same purpose of essentially taking over the Ataturk Republic and turning it into an Islamist state. Hey, Claire, let me just ask you, because you're deeply knowledgeable about these guys and what they're up to. The narrative that is being pushed at the moment by many in the press about Gulen is that he is a Sufi. And his form of Islam is very moderate. They cite some of his writings and his followers to make this case. I take it from what you've just said that if there's not a dime's worth of difference between his form of Islam and the jihadist Sharia-adherent form of Erdogan, that this would not be so.
Well, I mean, let's be clear about what a Sufi is. While it has the attributes of mysticism and contemplation attached to it, it certainly does not mean that Sufi is now divorced from jihad. Quite to the contrary, one of the most senior and authoritative of all Islamic scholars was Al-Ghazali, who was himself a Sufi, but very much a jihadi as well. And more to recent times, let's look at Shamil Basayev.
Claire, hold this thought. We're going to have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we'll talk more with Claire about these traditions within Islam and what they might mean, especially as practiced by the Saudis, our putative friends. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Our guest is Claire Lopez. We're talking with her about many aspects of the challenges our country is facing at the moment, particularly, but not exclusively, from those who believe that it is God's will that they impose Sharia on all of us via jihad. And Claire, you were just saying that this meme that Sufis are by definition not jihadists is not borne out by historical experience, including some fairly recent.
Right. I was going to mention Shamil Basayev, of course, who was the Chechen jihadi responsible for the horrific 2004 Beslan school massacre. So being a Sufi certainly is no impediment to being a jihadi at the same time, and I think that Fethullah Gulen embodies that as well. Whether he was involved in this coup attempt or not, I don't think so, simply because his major strength is with the police and the judiciary, less so the military. But it would be, of course, in Erdogan's interest to make him a scapegoat, since the two did fall out and are now mortal enemies. Not about ideology. It's all over power.
I would argue it is in our interest to roll up what Fethullah Gulen has been doing in our own country. And again, this is documented to a fairly well in Claire's book with Chris Holton, Gulen and the Gulenist movement, Turkey's Islamic supremacist cult, and its contributions to the civilization jihad. As with all of our works, folks, you can check them out for free online at securefreedom.org. I strongly commend this one to you. Claire, you have also, of course, co-authored recently with me, See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism, and the Disarming of America's First Lines of Defense. And that would seem to me to be the sort of subtext, really, of what we've now learned with the release last week of the long-awaited 28 pages that had not been made available to the public out of the congressional 9/11 sort of post-mortem. These all concerned the Saudis and what they've been up to. Talk, if you would, a little bit about our putative friends, the House of Saud, and what we've learned from these 28 pages.
Well, the 28 pages finally declassified, I think, draw a picture of a network of individuals, companies, mosques, organizations in the United States pre-9/11 that were what we would call the U.S. branch of the global jihad movement. They included supporters of Al-Qaeda, supporters of Osama bin Laden, the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas fronts like the Holy Land Foundation, Saudi-funded mosques, the Blind Sheikh, and others. And what binds this all together was the support that was apparently provided, material, financial, and otherwise, to two of the 9/11 hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar, who arrived in San Diego, California in January of 2000, well before the September 2001 attacks that they were part of. And the investigation evidence in these 28 pages points very directly to the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., and the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles, California, as the coordination hubs for this support operation to these two hijackers, and apparently with the involvement of Saudi intelligence officers who were assigned to these diplomatic facilities of the Saudis, playing very key roles in the support to the hijackers.
Claire, this is really a stunning smoking gun, it would seem to me, is it not? I mean, am I missing something that this level of direct involvement of, as I say, ostensibly friendly nation, and it seems because they were a friendly nation, a blind eye was really turned to their operations in the United States, arguably after 9/11 as well as before.
Well, particularly after, and we might point to the role of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who was the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 all the way till 2005, and he had done a superb job of cultivating very close ties to top U.S. leadership, obviously, for decades.
Yeah, I believe the George Herbert Walker Bush family called him Bandar Bush. He was so close to
them. And it may be in part that relationship that helped shield the Saudis eventually from suspicion or follow up on these points of the investigation. Now,
certainly the permission given,
though,
Claire Lopez, the permission given to let a number of Saudi nationals, including relatives of the bin Ladens, flee the country in the immediate aftermath when there was still a no-fly order in place for the rest of us.
But I would have to say that now, having seen these 28 pages, read them, and having been an expert witness in a case called the Havlish case, which investigated the involvement of Iran and Hezbollah in the 9/11 attacks, and concluded in 2011 with a judgment from Judge George Daniels of the Southern District of New York that Iran and Hezbollah were co-responsible with Al-Qaeda for the attacks, I would have to say that the Saudi involvement is at least equaled, if not well surpassed, by the role of Iran, which likewise got zero attention. I mean, for instance, it was the Hezbollah operative, Imad Mughniya, who actually recruited some of the Saudi hijackers inside Saudi Arabia, flew with them on the planes from Saudi Arabia to Iran for their training, and escorted them around the Middle East on a lot of their training and pre-9/11 planning trips. So,
but Claire, what
Iran
you just described
got completely off, let off the hook.
Yeah, what you've just described is something that flies in the face of sort of the canonical official U.S. government view of the rift between the Sunnis and the Shia, explicitly in the case of the Saudis on the one hand, the Sunnis, and the Iranian Shia on the other. Namely, that they hate each other and they couldn't possibly collaborate with one another. And I guess I would just ask you to further explicate the extent to which this cooperation is now known and how that could be given this supposed enmity.
Well, what we have to understand is that in the Islamic view of things, the world is divided into two parts. The Dar al-Islam are places where Sharia is enforced, the House of Islam. Dar al-Harb, House of War, are those places where Sharia is not enforced. Guess which part we're in. Now, that's at a macro level. And at that level, Sunnis and Shiites have, will, and do cooperate with each other against the non-believers, against the infidels, the kuffar. And 9/11 is a perfect example of this, both at the nation-state level, as we now can see, and at the sub national level with groups like Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. But at a lower level, on the ground, as we see in the Middle East today and forever since the Battle of Karbala in 680, Shiites and Sunnis very happily tear one another to shreds, quite literally, on doctrinal disagreements and so forth. But we have to understand that things happen on different levels and sometimes simultaneously, and they seem opposed. But in reality, in the Islamic view of things, they can happen at the same time. 9/11 cooperation between Sunni Al-Qaeda and Shiite Hezbollah and Iran, Sunni Saudi Arabia, is a perfect example of that.
And at the very least, it should underscore the point for us that our reliance on any of these characters to be faithful allies and protectors of our interests is a dubious proposition, certainly not one that can be taken for granted, let alone accommodated with a kind of willful blindness that that Senator Ted Cruz has documented is so much in evidence these days in the United States government. One of the people who is not willfully blind, or blind at all for that matter, is of course our guest, Claire Lopez. We have one more segment coming up with her right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Claire Lopez, the co-author with me of See No Sharia, Countering Violent Extremism, The Disarming of America's First Line of Defense. She has edited and authored numerous other books with us at the Center for Security Policy, where she serves as our vice president for research and analysis. Indispensable, I think, and deeply appreciated. Claire, we've been talking a little bit about Iran and its involvement in the 9/11 attacks. It has been, of course, involved in a number of other terrorist attacks, both against this country and its people and others, for decades. President Obama, nonetheless, just about a year ago, engineered an agreement with the Iranians, a political understanding, we're told, not a signed deal, certainly not a treaty. A year on, tell us how the deal looks, and more to the point, what we must expect from an Iran that successfully engineered it with us.
Well, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as they call it, agreement, which, as you rightly point out, was never signed on any single page of it by anyone, but reached between Iran and the P5 plus one, that's the permanent five members of the Security Council, plus one is Germany, about 1 year ago, basically allowed Iran's nuclear weapons program to continue. They got to keep all their infrastructure. They got to keep all their centrifuges. They had to unplug a few. They were allowed to continue advanced centrifuge research. They got to keep their ballistic missile program, which wasn't even included in the JCPOA. And we see them testing missiles now to great outcry, but it's not in the JCPOA. It's not in there. They continue blatant support for terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, the Taliban, destabilizing activities across the region of the Middle East, particularly in support of their puppet regimes in Baghdad and Damascus, and then, of course, continued with horrific human rights atrocities against the Iranian people. And all of this under the presidency of Hassan Rouhani, who was billed as a moderate, and the JCPOA billed as something that would boost his and other so-called moderates' possibilities for influence inside of Iran. Clearly, all of that woefully misplaced. I've just recently penned an op-ed over the weekend, actually, which I'm waiting to have published on this very topic, and I'd also point our listeners to a recent book just published by our colleague at the center, Fred Flights, who wrote the book The Obama Bomb, rightly focusing on the fact that the Iranians have been given a glide path to a deliverable nuclear weapon under the Obama administration.
It is staggering, I think, is the only way to describe what Fred Flights has chronicled in Obama Bomb. And what you've done so much over the years to describe as well, Claire Lopez, the prospect that any good can come of giving a regime with this record, and if anything, more and more inclined to exhibit quite explicitly its abiding hostility towards us, of giving them $150 billion. I mean, this is, it seems to me, truly national security malfeasance as well as fraud. Claire, one of the other things that you've been working on, and I just want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about it, is trying to bring about a new government in Iran. You have been party to a number of meetings, including one last weekend, organized by this group called the MEK, an opposition group. Tell us a little bit about the group and the meeting and where you think things stand with their efforts.
Yes, well, the MEK, Mujahedin-e Khalq, is one member of the broader Iranian opposition coalition called the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran. The two of them were both on the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organizations list just until 2012, but at the explicit behest of the Iranian president in 1997, President Khatami, who prevailed upon then-President Clinton to just put them on the list because he wanted them to be on the list. They were taken off the list after long litigation through the courts in Europe and in the United States and won their case that they did not belong on that list. And they hold an annual huge rally in Paris every year, the most recent of which took place last weekend on Saturday, July the 9th. 107,000 people, we're told, under a enormous conference center, convention center, and included many delegations from around the world, including a high-level delegation from the United States that included Judge Michael Mukasey and former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, also former FBI Director Louis Free, former U.S. National Security Advisor Fran Townsend, and former Governor and also Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and others. What the agenda is regime change in Iran, not necessarily to replace the mullah's regime with their own, that's not the idea, but rather to free the Iranian people to choose freely their own leadership, which is not the case now, despite a facade of democratic elections that they hold every so often over there. And there is a 10-point plan by the NCRI president-elect leader, Mariam Rajavi. The 10-point plan can be found online, but it includes support for things like a free market capitalist economy, gender equality, no more WMD, weapons of mass destruction, end to support for terrorism, equality under the law. As we said, the Prince Turki bin Faisal al-Saud, the former intelligence director of Saudi Arabia, part of the royal family, does not hold a position officially now, but appeared at the convention to pledge support to the NCRI for regime change in Iran, I think is tremendously significant. We know from discussions that arrangement took many months to negotiate. And now, as we see, there's a kind of a tripartite alignment that has taken place in the Middle East that I think none of us could have imagined a short time ago, and that is the Saudis talking to the Israelis and now including the Iranian opposition, NCRI. And the reason for all of that is fear of the aggressive expansionism of the Shiite regime in Tehran and its regional destabilization drive for deliverable nuclear weapons, too.
Right. These are truly extraordinary times, and we'll be following closely, as I know will you, Claire, of the efforts of this opposition group and the prospects for change inside Iran when the Obama administration's efforts are doing nothing but shoring up and strengthening this regime. Claire, lastly and very quickly, could you just give us 1 minute on Hillary Clinton and Benghazi, as she is much in the news at the moment, and it's the moment for reflection on what actually came out of that episode.
Yeah, the announcement by FBI Director James Comey a week or so ago that the FBI, after a long investigation, would not recommend indictment of Hillary Clinton to the Justice Department over the email server issue. This does still leave the issue of the investigation into pay for play, as they say, as Peter Schweitzer has documented so well in his book, the investigation into the Clinton Foundation and whether there was malfeasance there in terms of favors given for donations provided. But in any case, this absolved Hillary Clinton of at least that one aspect of potential indictment over her emails and of the server. And, of course, this plays into the entire Benghazi debacle because, of course, as Secretary of State at the time and through the tremendous work of organizations like Judicial Watch and other media, Fox and Breitbart, we know that some of those emails contained information about her role in the Benghazi debacle,
including the cover-up.
Leaving our people unprotected.
Claire, thank you so much for all of this great work. We are deeply grateful to you for discussing it today, but also for doing it day in and day out at the Center for Security Policy. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you soon. In the meantime, stay well, keep up that good work. And next up, we will look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.